Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit progressive.com to see what you can save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe. Discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly.
And I am your co-host and Kelly's husband, Austin.
Welcome back, Austin. We're so happy to have you here. Let's go. Took a break last week, not really for any reason.
The main reason being that Casey Anthony decided she wanted to get on social media and advocate for women. And so once that happened, Kelly blew her top. Didn't talk to me for about 7 hours a day while she was just pigeonholed into her office like a hermit crab, destroying the woman. That's kind of my take on things. Yours?
I think that's actually 100% accurate.
Okay, cool.
That's exactly what happened.
Cool.
I had every intention of recording, and then Casey Anthony decided to show her face on TikTok. And you all know me, how passionate I am about this entire case. It's the one thing that really got me interested in true crime in the first place.
And then really put the podcast hardcore on the map. Mm-hmm. I mean, the podcast was growing, but whenever the mockumentary, as you call it, came out and mm-hmm. you did that, the podcast really took off.
Correct.
And Kelly's like kind of become notoriously the biggest Casey Anthony hater in the world.
Yeah. And it's a badge I wear proudly. She's on TikTok. And if you are here from TikTok, you might know I have a pretty decent following on TikTok with like about 200,000 followers right now. And I was really like, not again, not again. She's not doing this again. Mm-hmm. And so
I got on there and made a series of TikToks, and those went off pretty well. And then her Substack, guys, listen to this. I feel like I'm talking to my friends when I say this. Listen to this. So she announced herself coming back to social media by joining Substack. So she made this TikTok to basically redirect everyone on TikTok to Substack. But she did make mention of how she was going to like make a bunch of videos.
And she has comments off on everything because nobody in the world likes her.
She has comments off on TikTok, on Substack. And there is a common misconception that you have to pay to subscribe to her channel on Substack in order to comment. But that's not true, because she made this post basically telling everyone to be careful about what they say because they could be charged with defamation or liable, she said. And I commented on it, not as a subscriber, because I will never give her a dime of my money, but obviously. I said, I think you mean libel, not liable, moron.
And so then she
deleted the comment, corrected her mistake on the original post, and blocked me. And so when I tried to go back and see if she had posted anything new, it said, Casey Anthony blocked you. And I was like, yes!
Yeah.
She knows who I am.
She doesn't like Kelly, and Kelly doesn't like her.
Yeah.
But the one thing about Casey Anthony is, and I think I can say this confidently, you know, it's not like having a political belief, or even if you want to get, like, take out the politics of it, getting into, like, Ukraine or talking. It's not like talking about something where, like,
it's a very divisive subject.
Yeah. Or and where, like, somebody could stand on the other side and say, even if they agree with you, and be like, yeah, but I disagree with it. No, I don't think anybody can defend Casey Anthony.
There's one thing Democrats and Republicans alike can agree on, and it is
Casey Anthony sucks. That's what you were going to say?
Yeah.
I was covering you because I thought you were going to say, like, some naughty language. And so I was just going to, but you said the same thing.
Yep. Nope. So anyway, if you are on TikTok, go check out my videos. And if you want a refresher, those episodes are 110, 111, 112, and 113. And maybe 114. I don't remember.
Or you can watch the 15 parts on Kelly's TikTok.
Yeah. But anyway, I will always, if Casey has zero haters, it's because I am dead. Okay. I will always, always be a Casey hater. All right. Anyway, without further ado, Austin, have you heard about the story of Maura Murray?
No.
So this was a story that's been requested multiple times for me, not only to cover on the podcast, but for me to tell you, because it is this baffling missing persons case. And it's probably the most baffling missing persons case of the 21st century. So
really,
it is something that many, many, many people in the true crime space are familiar with. And so I'm going to tell you what happened. However, I want to preface this episode by saying that there are so many episodes and podcasts and books and posts and all the things that really get into the weeds of this story with like conspiracy theories and just theories in general. And I'm really kind of trying to just stick to the timeline and give you guys just the most basic understanding of this story without really getting into all of the nitty-gritty details of the theories, because I could just be here all
day. Well, if you're super interested, it's kind of like the down the hill.
Yeah.
Which case is that?
The Delphi murders.
The Delphi murders. Like, mm-hmm. I know from being around you in Crime Con, there's people that geek out about it in full-on podcasts that are devoted to every single episode's that.
Yes.
And I feel like maybe that's this, where it's like you could go on a whole rampage and talk about this for hours.
Yes. And if there, if this episode piques your interest and you do want to learn more, I suggest going over to Media Pressure. It's a podcast hosted by Sarah Turney, and she has interviewed with Julie, which is one of Maura's sisters. And I think she does a really good job on that podcast. And it's way more of a deep dive. I think there's like an 8 or 10 part series just on this case alone. So without further ado, let's get started.
Let's go.
On February 9th, 2004, Maura, a 21-year-old nursing student at University of Massachusetts Amherst, vanished without a trace after her car was found abandoned on a remote stretch of Route 112 in Woodsville, New Hampshire. And the eerie nature of her sudden disappearance, combined with the layers of mystery and unanswered questions, has led to decades of speculation. Was Maura running away from her life? Did she meet with foul play? Or was she simply in the wrong place at the wrong time? While police have considered the possibility that she left voluntarily, her family and many true crime followers believe something more sinister happened that night. So this is the full chronological story of the disappearance of Maura Murray. She was born on May 4th, 1982, in Hanson, Massachusetts, to Fred and Lori Murray. She was the fourth of five kids in a big Irish Catholic family. Her parents divorced when she was a kid, but both parents remained very active in their lives. Mora was especially close to her father, Fred, who coached her in track and cross country. Mora was smart, athletic, and driven. In high school, she was the top runner on the track team, and she did very well academically. She actually set the school's record for the 1.5 mile run, beating records of both the girls and the boys at that time, of anyone who ever attended the school at that time. She was also in the Latin Club and the National Honor Society. She was well-liked and had a tight-knit group of friends. On her SATs, she scored a 1420, which is nearly perfect. So, like, I just need you to understand how incredible Mora is. She was getting offers from Ivy League schools like Harvard and Yale, okay? But after graduating high school, she chose to follow in her older sister Julie's footsteps and enrolled at West Point, one of the toughest and most prestigious military academies in the country. I believe you have to get a nomination from a senator to even be considered to join West Point.
I just knew West Point was badass, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And, I mean, her and her sister both went. I mean, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. But she had a congressional nomination from the late Senator Edward Kennedy. She started off strong, dominating the intense round of Beast Barracks, which is a six-week summer training program for new cadets that is designed to be excruciatingly difficult. And in one person's post that I saw as I was just researching about Beast Barracks and, like, what it entails, somebody said there were 1,200 cadets accepted in their group, and nearly 100 of them quit on the first day.
Damn.
Can you imagine getting that far only to be like, I can't do this? I can't imagine that.
Yeah,
but
that's wild.
But Mora made it through that first year. And then during her sophomore year, she started to kind of slip up and make some poor decisions that were really out of character for Mora. First was a shoplifting incident that happened during a training exercise at Fort Knox in the summer of 2001. Fort Knox, okay? This place is like the cliche of high security, can't get away with shit in Fort Knox, can't get in, can't get anything out. Like,
Fort Knox is where the gold is, supposedly.
Oh, I don't know about all that, but all I know is that when people say, oh, it's locked up like Fort Knox, it's because it is so secure. So the fact that she was caught attempting to steal $5 worth of makeup from the base commissary was just kind of like a what are you thinking moment, you know? Like, yeah. why would you do that? And when she was confronted, she immediately admitted to taking the items, and she cooperated fully with the investigation. And when her sister asked her about it, she was really just embarrassed and didn't really have a reason, but she was just humiliated that she got caught.
Mm-hmm.
Now, West Point has a strict honor code, and even minor infractions were taken very seriously. So she was required to face a disciplinary hearing. And then rather than go through the lengthy process and potential consequences, she ultimately chose to leave the academy and transfer to UMass Amherst to study nursing.
Damn, that's a fumble after working your ass off so hard to get in.
Yeah, but I think she also just realized at that point that what she really wanted to do with the rest of her life was probably nursing, and that wasn't something that West Point offered, but at Amherst did offer it, and it was a rigorous program. So, I mean, in the way I view it, it's like she traded a prestigious future for another prestigious future, in my eyes. I mean, maybe not everyone will agree with that, but I still think she had high potential.
Yeah, for sure. It doesn't just all get thrown out the window because I agree with that.
Yeah. So at UMass, Mora juggled a demanding nursing program, two part-time jobs, and a long-distance relationship with her boyfriend, Army Lieutenant Billy Roush, who she met at West Point. And she was on the cross-country and track teams at UMass Amherst. So by all accounts, she seemed to kind of have her life together, but there were some signs that she was struggling under the surface. So in late 2003, Mora got caught using a stolen credit card to order food, and she admitted to finding the card number on a receipt and just using it. It wasn't a major crime, but it was enough to land her in some serious trouble. And if she was able to stay out of trouble for 3 months, the charges would be dropped. So some people believe that Maura may have been dealing with some personal issues that went deeper than just the school stress. There were rumors that she was struggling with an eating disorder, and this was kind of vaguely confirmed by her sister Julie in a TikTok of hers that I watched, because she is active on TikTok. But Maura really seemed to be under a lot of pressure. And I also saw some reports of her ordering a ton of food, but she would be the only one there to receive it. Like, she was only ordering a ton of food for herself, which is kind of indicative of possibly bulimia, where you binge eat all this food and you're throwing up and binging. It's like this whole, I don't know if you are familiar with how it works.
I know what bulimia is, but I would have just, I mean, without you saying that was a thing, I would have just thought she was hungry. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, things really took a turn for the worse in early February of 2004. Maura crashed her dad's car after a party, and then just a few days later, she had a breakdown at work. Something was clearly wrong, but nobody knew exactly what was going on with Maura. And then just days later, she disappeared. So let's talk about the days leading up to her disappearance. We're going to start with Thursday, February 5th. Maura was working a late night shift as a security desk assistant at Melville Hall, which is a dormitory on the UM Amherst campus. At around 12:40 a.m., she received a phone call that seemed to leave her visibly shaken. She was crying uncontrollably to the point that her supervisor actually had to escort her back to her dorm room. And when she was asked what was wrong, she just practically catatonically responded, "My sister." Like, she just was on another planet is like the only way I know how to explain it. But Maura's sister Kathleen later clarified that they had a phone conversation that night, but that it wasn't about anything particularly distressing other than that she was having some relationship problems with her fiance. And I want to note that it didn't come out until October of 2017, 13 years later. And I don't know why it would be this late. Maybe I got the detail wrong, but the details of the phone call were actually about how Kathleen, who struggled with alcoholism, had just left rehab and her fiance took her to a liquor store on the way home, causing her to relapse. So maybe that's why Maura got really upset. We don't know. Mm-hmm. But her emotional state that night was obviously concerning. Maura seemed disconnected. She was staring blankly at times and then sobbing uncontrollably at others. She was barely able to respond when she was asked what's wrong, and she seemed completely overwhelmed. Her supervisor later recalled that Maura's behavior was unlike anything she'd ever seen before. Eventually, when she calmed down enough, her supervisor offered to walk her back to her dorm at around 1:20 a.m. And though she initially refused, she ultimately agreed and was seen entering her room alone. And there is no record of her making any further phone calls or reaching out to anyone else that night. I do want to note, though, that the same night as this emotional breakdown, February 5th, there was an unsolved hit-and-run accident involving a UMass student named Petrit Vasi. And some have speculated that there was a possible connection between this incident and Maura's distress, although there has been no concrete evidence to link the two events, okay? Mm-hmm. It's just something I think people will call me out for if I don't at least mention. And then Friday, February...
And you don't think they were linked?
I don't think so. I'm just trusting the timeline. I'm trusting the statements from her family. So Friday, February 6th, all of the classes at UMass were canceled because of a snowstorm. At 10:10 p.m., between 10:10 p.m. and 10:38 p.m., Maura talked to her older sister, Kathleen. Then from 12:07 a.m. to 12:14 a.m., Maura is on the phone with Billy, her boyfriend. At 12:20 a.m. is when officers discovered Petrit Vasi laying on the road after a hit and run. So, I mean, I can see why the timeline seems to kind of line up. Like, she was awake at that time, but, I mean, is it that unusual for a college student to be awake in the midnight hours? No.
No.
So, Saturday, February 7th, Maura's father, Fred Murray, came to Amherst for the weekend. He had plans to help Maura shop for her new car because she had a 1996 Saturn, but it was proving to be unreliable. So they spent the day visiting multiple dealerships, but they just never settled on a purchase. That evening, Fred took Maura and her friend Katie to dinner at a local brew pub where they ate and discussed her future plans. And then after dinner, Fred gave Maura his debit card and reminded her to withdraw some cash if she needed anything. Later that night, Maura and Katie attended a small party at their friend Sarah's dorm. They brought alcohol that they had purchased earlier, including wine and vodka. And according to reports, Maura had a few drinks but did not appear overly intoxicated. However, witness recollections from that night are vague, with Sarah and Katie later stating they didn't recall many details about the gathering or who else was present. There were conflicting reports about whether Maura seemed upset or distracted that evening, and some accounts suggest that she was quiet and withdrawn, while others say that she was acting normally. Now, at some point, Maura used her dad's ATM card to withdraw $40, though it's unclear what the money was used for. My guess is probably the alcohol.
I was going to say alcohol or something. I mean, it's college kids.
Yeah. But she left the party after a few hours, saying that she needed to return her father's car to her dad's motel that he was staying in. Now, early February 8th, so this is Sunday, around 2:30 a.m., Maura left the party in her father's new Toyota Corolla to drive back to his motel. On the way, she crashed the car into a guardrail on Route 9 near Hadley, Massachusetts. A passing motorist stopped and called the police, and when the officer arrived, Maura was cooperative but appeared visibly upset. Surprisingly, there were no sobriety tests administered. There was no citation given. The responding officer arranged for the car to be towed, and then Maura was driven back to the Quality Inn where her father was staying. The damage to the car was pretty extensive, with repairs estimated between $8,000 and $10,000. And this is 2004, so it would probably be even more now. Yeah. But needless to say, a lot of damage to the car. She called her boyfriend Billy at 4:49 a.m. from her dad's phone, but it's unknown if he answered or what they talked about if he did answer. Now, that morning, Fred discovered what had happened to his car, and he reassured Maura that they would be okay, that they would handle the insurance claim. It was going to be okay. He reminded her to go to the DMV to obtain an accident report form, and that'll be important later. And according to Fred, Maura seemed remorseful, but not overly distressed. Before he left for Connecticut later that morning, he urged her to take care of the paperwork and reminded her that they would talk later that night. Meanwhile, Maura spent the rest of the day in her dorm speaking to no one about the accident. And it's also worth noting that Fred did make a point to tell Maura, don't be driving around that Saturn. It's proven to be unreliable. Just wait until we get you a new car. So Monday, February 9th is the day that Maura disappeared. And again, classes were called off due to a snowstorm. At 12 a.m., Maura searched online for directions to Burlington, Vermont, and the White Mountains area of New Hampshire. At 1 p.m., she called a rental property in Bartlett, New Hampshire, but she did not book a stay. And then she emailed Billy saying, quote, I love you, Maura Stud. I got your messages, but honestly, I didn't feel like talking too much of anyone. I promise to call today, though. Love you, Maura. And then she called the owner of a condo in Bartlett, New Hampshire, which was a place that was special to Maura. And it was apparently a place that her family would vacation to in the past. So she tried calling this condo. At 1:24 p.m., she emailed her professors claiming that she would be out for a week due to a death in the family, which was not true. At 2:05, she called a number that gives you a recording with information about booking hotels in Stowe, Vermont. You have to remember this is 2004, so it was probably, you know, a thing to call and just get a recorded information. Do you remember ever having to call the movies to get like a listing of all the movies or look in the newspaper?
Yes.
Before like the internet was really a thing?
Do you remember? I'm really dating myself here. Every morning I would get a phone and I would call 279-7777 for the weather.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
Did you ever do that?
Yeah. I remember doing that, especially if I was afraid it was going to storm because I was hoping that it wouldn't say there was like a severe thunderstorm warning if I was at home alone. Anyway, sorry. This is crazy. A side note. And if you're of age, you will get it. And if not, you're like, get on with the story. Okay. So
you guys were born in the 1900s.
That's what our children say.
Jack asked me one day how much a gun cost in the 1900s.
Oh, my God. Okay, anyway. 2:18 p.m., Maura called her boyfriend Billy Roush, leaving a voicemail that simply said, I love you, I miss you, I want to talk. Then she packed a bag with clothing, toiletries, her birth control pills, and her college textbooks. At 3:15, she withdrew $280 from an ATM, nearly emptying her bank account, And surveillance footage confirmed that she was alone at the time when she did it. And I want to also note that prior to leaving her dorm, she had packed up almost all of her stuff. All of her artwork was off the wall. She had boxes that were packed with stuff. And there was also an email that had been printed out between her and Billy that was indicative that there was maybe some turmoil in their relationship. Mm-hmm. But I tried to find what the details of the email were, and I couldn't find it.
But she was ready to get out of there.
Yeah, I mean, clearly. It seemed like she was, making her way out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, calling all these places and out of town places and packing up all your shit and leaving.
But she didn't tell anyone what she was doing. Mm-hmm. So at 3:40 p.m., she purchased alcohol, including Bailey's Irish Cream, Kahlua, vodka, and a box of Franzia wine, or Franzia. I don't know how you say it. At 4:37, she checked her voicemail for the last time. And after this point, there was no activity on her phone. After 4:37 p.m., it's done.
Nothing.
Before we go on, I want to take a moment to shout out the sponsor of today's episode. So for Christmas, Austin got me this gift that I had been eyeing for a while, and it's an Aura ring. And this is not an ad for an Aura ring, but if you have an Aura ring, you might be able to relate to this. You track your sleep on it, and I love it because I'm naturally competitive. So it gives you this score every night, and I'm always aiming for like the best sleep score that I can get. And I struggle sometimes to fall asleep and stay asleep, but last night I got a score of 94, which is considered optimal. And that's why we are so excited to talk to you about Beams Dream Powder. This is a science-backed, healthy hot cocoa for sleep. This product has single-handedly changed the way I sleep for the better, and my Aura ring just proves it. But I could not believe how great it truly tastes. All you have to do is heat up 6 to 8 ounces of water or milk, use their frother to blend in the powder, and the drink tastes like a little dessert before bed. It truly does taste so good, but it's guilt-free. It's available in delicious flavors like my personal favorite, sea salt caramel, brownie batter, vanilla chai, and the Beam Dream Powder original flavor, cinnamon cocoa, which is also super good. Each serving is only 15 calories and 0 grams of sugar, but I swear you guys, this stuff tastes like it's a treat. I forget its purpose is to actually help me sleep and not just enjoy a yummy drink. But other sleep aids can cause next day grogginess. Dream contains this powerful, all natural blend of reishi, magnesium, L-theanine, epigenin, and melatonin to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up feeling refreshed. If you want to try Beam's best-selling dream powder, get up to 40% off for a limited time when you go to shopbeam.com/mama and use code MAMA at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/MAMA and use code MAMA for up to 40% off. And if you do try it, message me or tag me in your stories. Let me know how much you love it so we can enjoy this beautiful drink together. And Austin, did you want to add a little 2 cents?
Yeah, I don't even sell this stuff and Kelly still loves it. So it's good stuff. She likes it. Let's get on to the show.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., a local resident in Woodsville, New Hampshire, Faith Westman, called 911 to report a car accident on Route 112 near her home. The vehicle, a black 1996 Saturn, appeared to have gone off the road and collided with a snowbank. Faith reported seeing a young woman standing outside the car, appearing to be alone, and she also mentioned seeing movement inside the car, but couldn't determine if there was another person present. But according to the 911 log, she claimed to have seen a man smoking a cigarette in the car. And then later she kind of backpedaled and said she thinks maybe she saw a red light glowing in the car, like maybe from a cell phone, but that she didn't see a man or anyone with Mara. So who knows? But you also have to think, like, it's February. It's dark at 7:27. She heard a loud thump near her home. So I don't even know if she got out of her house to go look at what was going on or if it was all just through a window. Mm-hmm. But shortly after, a school bus driver named Butch Atwood was driving home when he spotted the crash scene. So he pulled up and he actually spoke with the young woman later identified as Mara Murray. Butch noted that she appeared shaken but did not seem injured. He described her as looking cold and afraid and stated that she was not acting normal, though he couldn't pinpoint exactly why. When he offered to call for help, Mara insisted that she had already contacted AAA, which was later confirmed to be a lie. There was no record of her making such a call. And then Butch thought her behavior was odd, mentioning that she avoided eye contact and seemed really anxious to just get rid of him. He left the scene, drove the short distance home, and called 911 himself, even though Mara was pleading with him at the time not to call 911.
Sounds to me right now like drunk driving, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a plausible explanation. Now, by the time police arrived at 7:46 p.m., Mara was gone. There were no visible footprints leading away from the car, suggesting that she may have been picked up by another vehicle. And the temperature that night was below freezing, making it unlikely that she would have wandered far on foot without some sign being left behind. So let's talk about what was found at the scene. Her black Saturn was locked with the airbags deployed and obvious damage to the front end. A box of Franzia wine had spilled inside the car, and there was a Coca-Cola bottle containing what smelled like alcohol found in the cup holder. Inside the car were Mara's gloves, makeup, textbooks, and a stuffed animal. There were blank accident forms, so she did go to the DMV to get those forms, but she just never filled them out. Mm-hmm. Her diamond jewelry and driving directions were all still in the vehicle. Her wallet, phone, and credit cards were all missing and have never been recovered. There was also a rag stuffed into the tailpipe, something that her father later suggested she may have done to reduce smoke from the damaged engine. But, I mean, if you're leaving the car there and if you turn it off, I cannot, for the life of me, think of any reason why somebody would do that.
Yeah, that's weird. I don't understand why you do that at all.
Yeah, that to me is a red flag. So a search dog ended up picking up Mara's scent from one of the gloves that was left in her vehicle, but it lost the scent at about 100 yards away from the crash site, suggesting that she may have entered another vehicle. She was reported as a missing person, although police initially seemed to believe that she was missing voluntarily, given that she had printed those directions, she had packed her belongings, and there was no obvious signs of foul play. However, to this day, Mara has never been found. At 12:36 p.m. the following day, February 10th, a BOLO, or Be on the Lookout, report for Mara was issued. She was reported as wearing a dark coat, jeans, and wearing a black backpack. A voicemail was left on her dad's home answering machine around 3:20 p.m. stating that her car had been found abandoned, but Fred was working out of state and he didn't receive this call. So at 5 p.m., one of Mara's older sisters contacted Fred to tell him what was going on, and then Fred contacted the Haverhill Police Department and was told that if Mara was not reported safe by the following morning, the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department would start a search. So on February 11th, Fred arrived in Haverhill to search for his daughter. A tracking dog tracked her scent, but like I said earlier, lost track of the scent at about 100 yards from her car. And her boyfriend Billy and his family also came to help, and Billy was questioned by police. And this was weird, but during his flight, his phone was turned off. You can't accept a call when you're on a flight, typically. Mm-hmm. So it was either off or in airplane mode. But while he was in the air, somebody left him a voicemail. And to him, it sounded like Mara sobbing on the other end. There was like sobbing and shivering and like labored breathing, like as if somebody was freezing. Mm-hmm. However, the call was traced to an AT&T calling card. Now, coincidentally, Billy's mom, Sharon, said that she had bought two calling cards for Mara the previous Thanksgiving. But then after police investigated it more, the New Hampshire State Police said that the call came from the American Red Cross, which makes zero sense.
Was there one nearby?
I have no idea. But the thing is, even though they said that, Billy and Sharon, his mom, and I don't know about Mara's family, but like they didn't agree. Even though the investigation tracked it back to the American Red Cross, they're still convinced that it came from that calling card.
Is that call been public, that voicemail?
No, not that I know of. Now, at 7 p.m. that day, the police stated that they believed she either voluntarily ran away or came to the area to commit suicide. But her family was just not accepting that as an answer. Mara's friends and family searched and searched until finally they had to resume their lives, kind of. Like, They checked out of their hotel on March 2nd, but Fred especially returned every weekend to help search for his daughter. Any off time, I can't even imagine that. And I know there are some people who will be like, I would never stop searching, but how do you survive though? I mean, how do you pay your bills if you can't work? I mean, how do you balance that if your kid goes missing? And not only that, but like your adult kid.
I can't even imagine the weight of that, carrying that every day.
No, I can't either. So before anyone is like, how do you just resume your lives? Don't even try. Until you've been in this situation, you'll never know how you would actually respond or what you would have to do to just survive. Mm-hmm. So on July 1st, police retrieved the items found in Mara's vehicle from her family for forensic analysis. And on July 13th, a one-mile radius search was performed by nearly 100 searchers, including state troopers, rescue personnel, and volunteers. But what made this one different was this was the fourth search around the crash site, but the first one performed without any snow on the ground. So at this point, the snow has melted, and they're hoping they're going to find something. Authorities were most interested in locating the black backpack that Mara had in her possession, but that was not found in her car. However, they found nothing. And then this was a pretty fucked up detail, but in late 2004, some man approached Fred Murray with this rusty stained knife that he was alleging belonged to his brother. This guy said that his brother and his girlfriend were starting to act really weird around the time of Mara's disappearance and thought maybe they had something to do with it. But the family members of the man who turned in the knife admitted that that guy just made up the story in an attempt to get some of the reward money from the investigation, and that he also had a history of drug use. It never fails to amaze me how shitty people can be in horrific situations, and it kind of reminds me of the Bianca Devin story where pictures of her after she was killed by her friend were broadcast all over the internet, and people were sharing the images. Mm-hmm. And there was one case where Bianca's mom was in the grocery store and somebody nearby airdropped her the photo of her daughter dead in the car.
Who does that?
Like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Now, we can go ahead and talk about some of the theories and the unanswered questions, but honestly, like, this story has so many rabbit holes that it would just be impossible to keep it concise. So we'll talk about it, but...
So is this where the story ends, though? I mean, she's just never been found.
She's never been found.
No one's ever been charged.
Mm-mm.
This is the end of the story.
This is it.
Oh, my.
The rest from here on out are just theories. Like, did she accept a ride from a passing motorist? I mean, that one seems like the most plausible. I mean, that one sounds likely, right? That somebody could have driven by and she accepted a ride from someone who had just maybe been passing through the area.
And so then she was kidnapped?
And so maybe she was kidnapped and met with foul play. I don't know. I mean, who could have picked her up? Like, if it was a good Samaritan, why hasn't that person come forward? And some people speculate that a local resident or a passing truck driver may have offered her a ride, possibly with no ill intent. And then others believe that she may have unknowingly entered a vehicle with someone who was dangerous. Like, talk about wrong place, wrong time.
Well, what you just said, though, makes a lot of sense. If any good Samaritan would have picked her up, they would say, hey, I picked her up.
Yeah, and period. I took her here.
Yeah. So like, that kind of determines in my non-investigative mind, like, either there was foul play.
Mm-hmm.
She was murdered, or she ran away.
Yeah. But also you have to think about the fact that there was a very small window of time between Butch Atwood, the bus driver, stopping and talking to her and then leaving and calling 911 himself.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody did pick her up, it would have to be in that short window. I think he called at like 7:27 and police arrived at 7:49.
Well, and it sounds like, I mean, my assumption is that it was a drunk driving accident, wouldn't you? Is that your assumption?
Yeah, I mean, I think she either was...
Makes the most sense.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume she could have been drinking and driving, but also her car was unreliable. And mm-hmm. so it was also very snowy. Classes had been canceled due to a snowstorm. So could she have lost control on an icy road and crashed? I mean, yeah. And the airbags deployed. Could she have suffered a little bit of a head injury that caused her to be confused? Like,
so then there were no footprints in the snow?
Correct.
At all?
Yeah, nothing that showed that she walked away from the vehicle.
No tire tracks.
Uh-uh.
just standard road tire tracks? I mean, was it a well-traveled road or no?
I think it was a decent rural one. Area.
That is not so a lot of traffic. Weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And no drivers have ever reported seeing a young woman walking on Route 112 that night, which, again, raises questions. Like, if she left in a vehicle, who was driving the vehicle?
Phone's off.
Phone is off.
But AT&T card, maybe.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is that at the time, 2004, people were really careful about their minutes, and especially their roaming minutes. So could she have turned her phone off in an effort to preserve those minutes? And then, so, I mean, I don't know.
She have had a burner phone on her, like the AT&T card that she supposedly called, but they said it was Red Cross?
I don't think so, because I think to use a calling card, you still have to, like, dial a number from the phone. So, like, it would still have to go through her phone service.
You could have a burner phone. Track phones were a thing back in the early 2000s.
I don't think. Why would you know that? And I don't think
they were a big thing. You'd go to the store and get one of those track phones and load it with 50 minutes or whatever, and you'd have a phone totally off the grid. It was a burner phone.
Yeah, now people do it to, like, commit crimes and sell drugs.
And I'm sure they did it back then.
If you have a phone and you're like, I don't, I just use it for my kids. Don't come for me. I'm just making kind of a joke.
Back then, though, people did also, though. So, I mean.
No, you're probably right, but I don't think that she had one. I just don't.
Yeah.
But another theory people believe is that she may have arranged to be picked up by someone she knew in advance. So some of her actions leading up to her disappearance, like searching for lodging in Vermont and New Hampshire, withdrawing all this cash, packing up her belongings, suggest that maybe she was planning to go somewhere. And so if Mara had planned to disappear, she may have coordinated with a friend or an acquaintance to pick her up. However, no such individual has ever come forward.
So insane. The only, like, logical thing to me is somebody picked her up and it was foul play. Something terrible happened. Or, like, the only other thing that would make sense to me is, like, she got picked up by somebody who promised her they wouldn't say anything, and she's off living some other life somewhere else.
Maybe.
Do you think she's alive still or no?
I don't. I unfortunately don't. It's been 20 years. Her family has been so vocal and present about her disappearance. There's no way that if she was still alive, she wouldn't have seen these pleas and come to her senses or made right. some sort of appearance somewhere that somebody could recognize her.
It's so strange, too, that she was this, you know, killer SAT score, athletic, gets into West Point, and then has this one mistake where she steals. But then it becomes a little bit of a pattern because another big mistake happens. And then there's all the stuff with drinking and then like it's just
possible it's eating, like, disorder. Like, I think yeah, there were, like, some underlying mental point? Health issues.
Yeah, that makes sense also. Yeah. Something was caused her to hit a tipping point.
Yes. Yeah.
Super sad, though. You had somebody who was tracking along with a very successful, positive, optimistic future.
Yeah.
And just came to a screeching halt, it seems like.
Yeah.
In a matter of months.
Maybe she kind of succumbed to the pressure. Because I can't imagine the type of pressure put on someone at West Point.
Right.
Or someone who's receiving all these accolades. I mean, it's definitely due to her hard work. I mean, she was a very hard worker, very driven. But did she become exhausted by the pressure? I mean,
well, think about the people you said that got there, worked their ass off to get in, and they leave.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that makes sense.
Yeah. And then if you do leave, do you carry shame because of that? I mean, obviously this is all speculative at this point. I'm trying to just place myself in Mara's shoes, like, and give her grace and benefit of the doubt that, like, maybe this was a mental health crisis.
Well, it's just us BSing about it. It's like, this goes back to something I always think about, and I've told you this, the idea of Sonder. So I talk to Kelly about this, like, kind of frequently, and it's just, like, a really deep thought that I have. And you might be like, hey, dude, you're out there, and that's fine. But Sonder is the profound realization that every person you encounter has a life just as vivid, complex, full of thoughts, feelings, experiences as your own. And it's the awareness that everyone around you is living a story as rich and intricate as your own, filled with their own dreams, struggles, relationships, and routines. And even if you never witness any of it.
Yeah, okay? And even if you don't know them.
It's, yes.
It's really, every single, I think I really experience that whenever I'm in a stadium full of people and I recognize how many people I do not know, and uh-huh. yet they're all just out there existing.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys, this is kind of a tangent. No, but, like, I wonder how many other people experience the same kind of phenomenon, like this heavy realization that you are one person and the world is enormous.
I think about it, and you know this about me, all the time. Mm-hmm. I'll be driving down the highway and see cars. I just think about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, I bring that up just to say, like, man, she was, whatever it was, she was going through some shit, obviously. I think we can say that for sure, right? Mm-hmm. With the couple things of theft and then the drinking and the bulimia or whatever, like she was going through some shit, mm-hmm. and the pressure of West Point and everything. And it's like, you don't know what it was doing to her. And I don't know. It's just interesting to think about. And she had her whole own life that none of us will ever understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's so much about her disappearance that didn't come out until years later too, that kind of give a little more context. And so it's like, yeah, you just really don't know. I feel like the idea of her being met with foul play is equally as plausible as her just choosing to disappear, mm-hmm. as heartbreaking as it is. So one of my thoughts was, could she have wandered into the woods and just succumbed to the cold? But I there's issues with that because investigators found no footprints leading into the woods, which makes this scenario unlikely. And if she would have gone into the cold and succumbed to the cold, she would have been found. That I feel like that would be inevitable if it were that simple. And the search dogs obviously lost track of her scent within about 100 yards of the accident. And the temperatures that night were well below freezing. So if she had walked into the woods, she would have been severely underdressed and vulnerable to hypothermia. Again, like, she would have been found, I think, mm-hmm. even if she wasn't alive. Like, I just think her remains would have been found if that were the case.
For sure.
So another theory is, did she stage the accident to disappear voluntarily? And there are those who believe that Mara was looking for a way to escape her life and that the accident was part of this planned disappearance. Because prior to leaving UMass, Mara searched for directions to lodging, and we realized that she had packed her bags and she had withdrawn all this money. But if she staged her disappearance, why hasn't someone spotted her? Not just why hasn't she resurfaced, why hasn't someone else said, hey, that's her? Or, you know what I mean? Like, how do you just start a whole new identity?
I don't think that's crazy. I mean, literally just this morning we were watching on Instagram with this guy who does haircuts in Wichita. It's crazy. And he makes people look 100% different. I don't think that's crazy.
Gosh.
I don't think it's crazy to say I'm going to completely change my identity and restart as a different person, yeah. in a different place, and no one's going to recognize me. I don't think that's crazy at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy in the sense of like, man, it's wild to wrap your head around, but it's not out there.
Yeah, no, I guess it. There's been other cases we've talked about too where people maybe voluntarily disappear. Hannah Kobayashi just did it, except she didn't successfully do it. That's like mm-hmm. a whole story in, of its own. But the other theory was she abducted, of course. So many, including Mara's father, believe that she was abducted. And if she did accept a ride from a stranger, she may have encountered someone with bad intentions. Again, like wrong place, wrong time type of situation. Mm-hmm. A witness later came forward stating that they saw a red pickup truck parked near the crash scene that night. So could this have been the vehicle that Mara entered? And some have pointed to known offenders in the area, but no strong evidence has linked them to Mara's case. And if Mara was abducted, there have been no traces of her left behind. There's been no confirmed sightings, no remains, no reported struggle at the scene. And you have to think again about that small window of time when all of this would have happened. Like, we're talking about the stars aligning for something like this to happen, that she accidentally wrecks her car. And then within the 20 minutes of being there, having a witness see it through her window, and then Butch Atwood driving by and calling 911, and then the 20 minutes that pass before the police show up, someone happens to come and pick her up that has bad intentions. I just feel like that's really coincidental.
But then I also think that if it was staged and she had somebody picking her up that promised not to say anything and she was starting a new life, it's been 20 years. You never had a realization to say, you know what, I'm going to come around. It's insane. That's a wild case.
Yeah. Nearly two decades have passed since Mara Murray disappeared, yet her case remains one of the most perplexing and debated missing persons cases in recent history. Despite extensive searches, forensic investigations, and widespread media coverage, tons of podcasts that even I know, Murder, She Told, Weird True Crime, Media Pressure, Crime Junkies, everyone has talked about this story. The Prosecutor's Pod, those are just some of my favorites. But No definitive answers have ever emerged about what exactly happened to her on that cold night in February of 2004. Law enforcement have conducted numerous searches in the area surrounding the crash site, including deploying cadaver dogs, ground-penetrating radar, and specialized teams, but no physical evidence of Mara has ever been recovered. Investigators have followed countless leads. Even today, there are leads that come in, but none have conclusively answered whether Mara left voluntarily, was met with foul play, or succumbed to the elements. Over the years, there have been reported sightings of Mara in various locations, but none have ever been confirmed. In 2019, human bone fragments were discovered at a construction site in Lincoln, New Hampshire, but they were later ruled out as being connected to Mara's case. Other leads, such as a possible basement location flagged by cadaver dogs and reports of a red truck seen near the accident site, have never produced solid evidence linking them to her disappearance. And in recent years, Mara's case has gained renewed interest through social media and true crime podcasts, leading to a surge in new theories and public discussions. And her family, particularly her father, Fred, has never stopped searching for answers. And like I said, her sister, Julie, is also very active on podcasts and on social media and on TikTok as well, sharing anecdotes about Mara, about her disappearance, answering questions, and all the stuff. Despite their efforts, they have been unable to secure the release of all investigative records, leading to frustration over the lack of transparency. In 2021, the New Hampshire State Police announced that they were conducting fresh searches and reviewing old evidence with modern forensic technology. Additionally, the FBI has been involved in aspects of the case, though no significant breakthroughs have ever been publicly disclosed. On the 20th anniversary of her disappearance in 2024, authorities released an updated age progression image of Mara to show what she might look like today, should she still be alive.
Those are wild.
The Murray family continues to push for answers, maintaining the belief that someone somewhere knows what happened to Mara that night. Ultimately, Mara Murray's case remains open, with law enforcement still encouraging anyone with credible information to come forward. Whether she left on her own accord or was met with danger, her family is still searching for the truth, hoping that one day the mystery of her disappearance will finally be solved.
That's crazy. That's a sad one. And yeah. It sucks that her family has to process this daily still.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. I saw one video where her sister pointed out that she has now been gone longer than she was alive on this earth.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that.
That's crazy. Okay. This episode's over, right? Mm-hmm. Before we go, I got to talk to you about randomness. Oh. So if you're a listener and you just want true crime, bounce Mama Mystery out. Okay.
Okay.
All right, last night I was on this rabbit hole where I was looking up stuff about time, and it led to like all different stuff. I'll tell you this real quick, okay? I was looking up the origin of time.
Okay.
Okay? You're yawning. Not interested. I just think it's interesting, and I think you'll find
it
interesting.
No, I want to hear it.
I was wondering when, like, who created time, this constraint of time, right? And when did we begin using time? And I got to tell you about it because it's interesting.
Okay.
The concept of time, both deeply philosophical and scientific, is a human-created tool for measuring change and a fundamental feature of the universe. But if we break it down, we can look at when and how humans began measuring time and whether time itself has an origin, okay? Humans created the system of time, though we don't know when, right?
Which is ironic.
That's weird, right? Like, how do we know humans created it?
And what time did we create time? Nobody knows.
If we mean time as a fundamental property of the universe, then time appears to have existed long before humans. In physics, it's woven into the fabric of space-time, meaning it likely emerged with the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. Anytime we start talking about that, I'm like, we don't know shit.
You lost me.
Yeah. Okay. But anyways, so back in 30,000 BCE, we had lunar and solar observations tracking moon phase and sun movement to keep track of time. The earliest known lunar calendar was carved into a bone in 32,000 BCE.
How do we know that?
I don't know. I'm just telling you what I think is interesting from research.
I know there's carbon dating and stuff. I don't understand it. And it's too crazy for me.
3,500 to 1,500 BCE. Was early sundials, okay? And then water clocks to measure time both in both at night or indoors was as early as late as 200 BC, and then mechanical clocks. Okay, I just thought all that was wild. I was like, what the hell? So then I got into this whole other rabbit trail. Have you ever heard of solipsism?
No.
Solipsism is a philosophical idea that only one's own mind is all that is certain to exist. So it questions whether...
Oh my God, Austin, I'm like too sober for this conversation. I feel like I need to like...
Have an edible
or something.
It questions whether anything outside of one's own consciousness, like other people, external world, or even time can be truly known to exist. And it can't be proven to not be real or to be real because... You can't prove if somebody else's mind is really happening or not.
Austin, you lost me.
It's wild.
Austin Evans, ladies and gentlemen,
I got into looking at black holes in space.
You've hijacked this episode.
Black holes in space. No. Nothing, not even light can escape them. Gravity is so strong. How do you understand a black hole?
Okay.
And if we were to fall in a black hole, this is the last thing I have to say. If we were to fall in a black hole, you would not survive. You would experience spaghettification, the stretching of your body due to intense gravitational differences. Time would slow down for you relative to an outside observer, and you'd eventually be crushed at the singularity of a black hole. Is that not deep? And black holes exist. Solipsism, whatever, that's wild. Time, black holes exist in the universe.
Is this like the Bermuda Triangle?
I don't know. They're black holes in space. Have you heard of black holes?
No, okay, but we're going to wrap this up because people don't want to talk about this.
Well, they could have stopped listening a while ago.
Listen.
Mama.
This would be great mystery. For a mama minute.
Out.
Get it? Because time, mama minute. Okay, bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.